A Memoir of the Reverend Edward Payson, Chapter 16. His exertion without the bounds of his parish, influence on his ministerial associates in resuscitating and edifying other churches, visits the springs, effects of his example, conversation and prayer on other visitors, excursions in behalf of charitable societies, translation of ministers. He is invited to Boston and New York. It is not easy to estimate the usefulness of a man in public life whose numerous relations bring him into contact with his fellow men in a great variety of circumstances. A minister of the gospel, especially at this day, is not an insulated individual whose influence is limited by parochial bounds. His presence, counsels, example, prayers, give shape, tone, direction, energy to public institutions for enlightening the human species, elevating its sufferings, and extending the empire of holiness. It is indeed no slight honor to be permitted to feed and build up a single branch of the Church of God, to see the number of believers multiplied and converted sinners joining themselves to the people of God as the fruit of his labors is an adequate reward for the pastor's most arduous toils and for all solicitude with which his anxious bosom is afflicted. And yet the increase and edification of his own particular charge may be only a small part of the good which is to be traced more or less directly to his instrumentality. The many hundreds to whom Mr. Payson's labors were blessed in the place of his residency, and whom it was his happiness to welcome to the church under his special supervision, are only a part, and may be found a small part of the gems, which will embellish his crown of rejoicing in the day of the Lord. To assert the whole amount of his usefulness, we must know the nature and degree of his influence upon his fellow laborers in the ministry, the effects of his occasional labors in different and distant parts of the country, his agency in raising the tone of piety in all the churches which could be reached by his influence, the results of his powerful pleading in behalf of religious and charitable enterprises, of his counsel and ecclesiastical concerns, and as one of the guardians of the principal seminary of learning in Maine, all in short that flowed from his conscientious and ever watchful regard, wherever he was and with whomsoever he met, to the apostolical precept, consider one another to provoke unto love and to good works. It is not intended here to give a character at the expense of his brethren, or to introduce their names as a foil to his excellencies. Such comparisons are always invidious, and besides, where many are associated in the same cause, it is difficult, indeed impossible, to define the precise degree of influence which ought to be ascribed to each. Though all probably will admit Mr. Payson's claim to a large share, and not a few on reviewing the past will see, in the excellencies of the churches in this region, and in the existing standard of ministerial disinterestedness and zeal, causes of thankfulness to the gracious providence, which raised up and sent such a man among them. His presence in the ministerial association to which he belonged, though often prevented by the frequent reoccurrence of his agonizing headache, and by duties at home which he could not dispense with, was highly valued by a majority of his brethren. He was a strong advocate for devoting the first part of the time occupied by such meetings to social prayer. Prayer was his own preparation for every duty, and he felt it to be equally important that it should be a common preparation for a social duty. When on a council for the ordination of a minister, he was always on the watch for some interval of time to be consecrated to united prayer, with particular references to the occasion and its consequences. In ministers' meetings, whether the immediate object was mutual edification or a solution where requested of cases of conscience and of the difficulties which often arise in the discharge of the sacred office or trying cases of discipline were presented for advisement, he was always ready to speak in his turn and always spoke to the purpose. A topic seldom passed him without fresh elucidation. Any proposition which bore the least trace of a time-serving policy or mere worldly wisdom, he would instantly discontinue it. The writer has known him to do this at once and effectually by very few words of his own, pointed with one of Witherspoon's characteristics. He occasionally performed services for other parishes of most ostentatious bearing on the cause of religion, services which thousands have regretted that his health and engagements would not permit him to repeat. The nature of the service alluded to will be seen as an instruct. Portland, January 7, 1814. My dear mother, not long after your return, I went to a town about 40 miles from this on a week's missionary excursion. They are in a wretched state, have had no settled minister for 7 years. The only minister they ever had proved an intemperate man. He is still living in the place and does all he can to prejudice the people against the gospel and all who will preach it. Before I proceed, I must take a little shame to myself, that God's goodness may appear more conspicuous. I commended my ride by going to G to obtain Mr. H to preach for me during my absence. The next morning it stormed violently. Then I began to repent of my undertaking. However, I was ashamed to go back. So on I went in the storm. I was tolerably good-natured the first part of the day, but the storm and the road grew worse and worse. First it was all mire and clay, then nothing but hills and stones. I began to grow cross. Every bad jolt made me worse, till I felt as bad as Jonah did, and was ready to say with him, I do well too to be angry. Being in this frame, I concluded, of course, that I should do no good. Wished myself at home 1,000 times, and more than half resolved that I would never have anything to do with a missionary tour again. However, I arrived safe and began my labors, and soon found that I was not laboring alone. I cannot go into particulars. Suffice it to say that in no place, not even in Portland, have I ever seen so much of God's power displayed in the same space of time as during the 6 days I spent in. I preached 6 times and made between 50 and families, roughly, visits, 40 to 50. Many were awakened. Almost all were solemn. One old man of 70, among the wealthiest in the place, who has always been against doing anything towards the settlement of a minister, was very deeply impressed and has promised to give $300 towards a fund. Two others will give $300 more each. I was obliged to return home on account of church fast and communion, but they have sent for me to come again, and next week, providence permitting, I shall go. Thus was I shamed and confounded by God's goodness. And this is not all. I came home thoroughly drenched by the shower of divine influences which began to fall there, and soon found that the cloud had followed me and was beginning to pour itself down upon my people. Instead of a fast, we appointed a season of thanksgiving. A blessing seemed to follow it. I then invited the young men of the parish to come to my house on Sabbath evening for religious purposes. The church thought none would come. I expected 20 at most. The first evening, 40 came, the second, 60, the third, 70. This was the last Sabbath. 6 stopped after the rest were dismissed to converse more particularly respecting divine things. About 30 persons are known to be seriously inquiring, and there is every apparency that the work is spreading. Meanwhile, I am so ashamed, so rejoiced, and so astonished to see what God is doing that I can scarcely get an hour's sleep. No account of the second visit has been preserved. The hopes, however, which had been excited by his first, were not disappointed. The change, which then commenced, prevailed, and was permanent. In the following spring, a candidate who had completed his preparation for the ministry under Mr. Payson's instruction visited the place, and during his first week found 10 persons who entertained a hope and heard of others, and 16 families whom he had visited more or less were inquiring, and in some instances whole families. Religion was almost exclusively the topic of conversation, and the whole society appeared solemn. The subscriptions to a fund for the support of a Calvinistic minister of the gospel had amounted to $3,000 or $4,000. This young preacher soon became the established minister of the place, where he still remains a useful laborer in the vineyard of Christ. Such were the results of one short missionary excursion. About 3 years later, by particular request, he spent a week in another town where some religious attention had commenced. It was a season of great solemnity. At his suggestion, the church assembled and renewed the covenant, whose bonds for a long time had been but little felt. The pastor led the way by acknowledging his deficiencies and then imploring forgiveness and strength for time to come, renewed his engagements to the Lord and to his people. His wife followed his example and was succeeded by the members of the church. During this visit, Mr. Payson preached 13 sermons. Besides attending the less public meetings and conversing with inquirers and the impenitent, and yet he was scarcely sensible of fatigue till he left the spot. He was so happy that he thought he might have exerted himself till he expired without knowing that he needed rest. Of 5 persons, the fruit of this revival, who were propounded to the church at one time, 4 were above 70 years of age. A service not very dissimilar in kind he once performed for several churches in his own neighborhood as one of a committee of the Cumberland Conference, much to their acceptance, and it is hoped to their spiritual advantage. During his public life, Mr. Payson made several journeys to the springs at Boylston and Saratoga for the recovery of his wasted health. The mixed characters collected together at this place, a fashionable resort, found him the logistic and earnest advocate of his master's cause. Here he was no less bent on the ruling purpose of his heart than when at home among his own favorite flock. A visitor from another state who took lodgings in the same house with himself and preserved some of his remarks and topics of discourse testifies that it was Mr. Payson's unusual practice in the evening to read the scriptures at a stated hour and offer prayer, which was attended by most of the families and boarders, and to spend half an hour after prayer in religious conversation with all who were disposed to remain. He always found many willing to hear, and the number continually increased. He observed to the visitor above alluded to that the time spent at the springs would not appear so much like a blank if he should be permitted to do anything for the cause of Christ. This privilege was granted him, for many left that boarding house with deep religious impressions produced through his instrumentality. One young man who had bent and resolved on finding new lodgings because there was so much praying where he was became the subject of deep conviction, and the very evening he expressed such a determination. The gentleman on whose authority these facts are stated observes of his prayers, they contain a great deal of instruction as well as devotion. He had the happy faculty of making his prayers preach. Yet while his conversation and prayers were so impressive and so full of instruction to others, he mourns over his own dullness as though the waters had washed every idea out of his head and every feeling out of his heart. The events alluded to in the foregoing paragraph transpired in 1815. Of the impression produced by a subsequent visit, some idea may be formed from the following letter addressed to the compiler. East Windsor, Connecticut, November 2, 1829. On his way to Niagara, Dr. Payson called at my house, purposing to rest a while and try the benefit of the waters. I had heard much of this excellent man, but never saw him till this time, and the impression he made on my mind at his first interview will not soon be forgotten. I was struck with the perfect simplicity, great dignity of his manners. His countenance was careworn, and he had the appearance of one sinking under the load of human infirmities and sighing for rest. Speaking of his trials on one occasion, he observed to me, "I have needed all along to be under the discipline of heaven, for nothing else could have kept me humble and saved me from perdition. I have ever been prone to depart from God, and have been kept only by a constant effort of His love. It seems to me, if God had not continually held the rod over me, and hewed up my way, I should have escaped from His hands, and been forever separated from His love. I expected, in answer to my inquiries, to hear of the victories of His faith, but He still spoke only of the wonderful power of God, which had kept Him and of His love to one, so unworthy and perverse. He spoke of his fierce temptations, and how he had been delivered by the mere mercy of God, and wondered that God should concern himself with such a worm, and that he did not leave him to be torn and devoured by Satan. In all my conversations with this wonderful man, I never saw him utter a word that bordered on boasting or savored of pride, but he seemed to have a surprising sense of his own unworthiness, and of the amazing love of God in making himself known to him and giving him a hope in his mercy. Among the virtues of his friend's character, that of humility appeared eminently beautiful and lovely, and shone in his whole deportment. In prayer his soul lay low before God. He frequently took part in family devotion, and here he excelled all the men I ever heard. He carried us up and placed us all in the divine presence. And when he spread forth his hands to God, heaven seemed to come down to earth, and the glory of the Lord shone around our tabernacle. He knew our wants, and he expressed them in language simple and affecting. He knew our miseries, and he told them all in such tones of tenderness and sympathy as made us feel that a friend was pleading our cause. While this holy man was talked with God and seemed to be overshadowed with the divine glory,
I have sometimes thought I could imagine what must have been the ecstasy of Peter when surrounded with the glories of the transfiguration scene. As these solemn seasons, when our brother has been pouring out his heart in deep complaints of sin and in fervent petitions for mercy, it has seemed as though the cloud of the divine presence covered the household of the divine majesty was very near us. The only exercise Dr. Payson performed in public while with us was the baptism of my youngest child. Some who heard his baptismal prayer observed afterwards that the subject of the infant baptism had never been exhibited to them in so convincing and solemn a light, and that they had never been so thoroughly impressed with the obligations of religious parents and the covenant rights of their children. In the bosom of a private family, Dr. Payson hoped to escape notice and find rest with the vexations of company, but he could not be long concealed. His retreat was soon discovered, and visitors thronged to see him. Our domestic circle was often enlivened by the presence and conversation of Dr. Payson. The children were not unnoticed by him, but shared largely in his attentions, and he seemed to take delight in sharing the toils of the nursery. Often would he take the child from the arms of its mother and carry it for hours together and sing some little air to divert it. His conversations were, for the most part, of a religious cast. He seemed inclined to dwell on melancholy subjects, and the strains of the mourning prophet suited him best. Yet now and then would he dwell on the sublime and animating themes of religion, and when he began on an exalted strain, he was surpassingly eloquent and instructive. He would seize hold of some thought and pursue it until it expanded and glowed under the splendor of his imaginary. On one occasion, he spoke of the probable condition of the soul of the believer when dying. At this awful period, when gasping in the agonies of death, and apparently insensible to everything around him, he supposed the world to be wholly shut out, and in this condition, while friends stand around and tremble to think of the unknown agonies he may be enduring, he supposes the light of God's countenance is poured in upon the soul, rendering him insensible to all his pains, and the soul is struggling and panting to escape from the crumbling tenements, and be at rest in the bosom of God. I can only give you the idea. It is impossible to reach his description. He seemed to dwell in the spiritual world, and to be most conversant with spiritual objects. This he manifested by pureness, by knowledge, by love unfeigned. He talked about death as we would talk about going from one place to another, and if any might adopt the language of Watts, much more might be. Receive my clay, thou treasurers of death. I will no more demand my tongue, till the gross organ, well refined, shall trace the boundless flights of an unfeathered mind, and raise an equal song. I add no more. Only that the visit of Dr. Payson and to my house left this impression upon our minds, not to be forgetful to entertain strangers, for thereby some have entertained angels unawares. Respectfully yours, Samuel W. Wellesley. A short passage from a letter of condolency addressed to Mrs. Payson by a friend in Connecticut will probably express the common sentiment of the many thousands who have listened to him, whether for a few moments only or for hours. I remember with most deep and interesting impression my last interview with your beloved and ever-to-be lamented husband. It was during a delightful ride of 5 or 6 miles on the borders of Farmington River. Never had I heard such discourse from the lips of man. Never had such an interview with a mortal. Even then he seemed like a pure spirit from another world. Such words of wisdom and such heavenly affections. I cannot efface the impression from my mind. The compiler had taken much pains to procure from companions of his journey some of the striking observations which were drawn from him by the natural scenery that he witnessed, by the various characters with whom he met, and the circumstances in which at different times he found himself. But at the times, even with those from whom he had the greatest reason to expect full and satisfactory replies, had been utterly fruitless. The general impression produced by his occasional conversation has been very strong and deep, and the effect powerful and abiding, but no one has ventured to report particulars. The words, and of course the precise sentiments, with numerous circumstances which rendered them peculiarly seasonable, like apples of gold in pictures of silver, are lost beyond recovery. While their effect remains, the impulse which he gave to our minds still keeps them in action and is still transmitting from mind to mind, which it is impossible for them to tell how this impulse was first imparted. The pleasure and the benefit remain, though the exciting cause has disappeared. So absorbed have persons been with the effect as to lose all distinct recollection of the means employed in producing it. This corresponds with the writer's experience. At the first visit which he ever received from Dr. Payson, some allusion was made to the opinion which prevails among Christians in common life, that ministers are in a situation peculiarly favorable to religious enjoyment, because their profession leads them to be incessantly conversant with divine truth. This said Mr. Payson, as just as if a hungry man, on entering the kitchen of a large, victualling house and inhaling the savory odor of the various dishes of rich food, hot from the fire in the oven with which the busy laborers were loading the tables, should exclaim, "What a blessed time these cooks have." During the interview, he uttered enough to make a valuable pamphlet, and yet this one comparison is all that I can be related with even tolerable justice to him. He had repeated applications from the directors of the principal charitable societies of the country to take journeys and collect funds for their respective operations. Of the first of these applications, he says, "I dislike begging and therefore thought I must go, but the hopes of a revival pulled me back." He, however, soon after made a beginning by visiting a few towns, the result of which did not encourage him to proceed. He was brought into circumstances which rendered it necessary to preach 10 times in 8 days, which, added to the fatigue of riding a great distance, proved too much for his strength and compelled him to relinquish the undertaking. In the early part of 1819, he made a tour confined chiefly to Exeter County, Massachusetts, in behalf of the American Education Society. His success in collecting money, though as great, probably, as his employers had any reason to anticipate, did not equal his own wishes. It was no slight trial, after preaching till he was half dead, to find only a few dollars contributed and then be obliged to retire and lay awake, brooding over his ill success half the night. His actual receipts, however, constituted but a small part of the advantage which the society realized as a consequence of his excursions. By such an advocate, its objects and its claims were favorably made known to the community. Auxiliary societies were formed and promises obtained from individuals of large donations. The amount of good which he accomplished on this journey cannot be estimated by dollars and cents. To obtain money was, with him, now and at all times, a very subordinate object. It was his great desire to exert an influence favorable to the spiritual welfare of ministers and children whom he visited. I labored as directly as I dared to persuade all the ministers where I went to expect a revival, and talk to them in my way about Christ. His unusual manner of conversing attracted attention and opened to his brethren new ways of awakening interest in the subject of Christ and his salvation. His prayers produced the same impression which they always had on strangers. An aged minister noticed the same quality in his prayers as did the lay visitor at the springs. He remarked after hearing them that prayer might be made as instructive as preaching, and wrote to a son in the ministry to have Mr. Payson preach for him, by all means, and especially to pray. Mr. Payson's excursions from time to time for the benefit of his health were the means of making him personally known in several of our southern cities as well as in New England and New York, and consequently on extending that pious influence which he ever exerted to the furthest boundaries of our land. There is nothing more true in theory than that a minister in the common property of a church at large, rather than of any particular division of the church, and that she has a right to his services in that place, which will afford the widest scope of the effectual and useful employment of the particular talents and qualifications. But various causes render the principle one of the most difficult application. Some unhappy consequences, perhaps, never fail to follow the transfer of a minister from one church to another, and no slight probability of increased usefulness can justify such removal. In order that such a change might bring any gain to the church general, a minister must do much more good in his new situation than he did in that which he left, for it will require much to balance the certain evils inseparable from his removal. When a pastor is established in the affections and confidence of the flock, and is laboring with more than ordinary zeal and success, any inferences from abroad might be regarded as a hazardous experiment. There may be much of selfishness in the refusal of a people to give up their minister, but certainly not more than there is in those who wish to obtain his services at their expense, and by whose solicitations their feelings are put to trial. Else, why does the choice of rich churches never fall upon any but ministers of established popularity or distinguished for their success, while many others, equal, perhaps superior in moral and intelligent worth, are placed over churches by whom their merits are not appreciated, and who only need a change of situation to take a rank among the most useful of Christ's ministers? The call of a church to the pastor of a sister church may be the call of God, and it may be the result of caprice or partiality or pride or other selfish passions. Those calls are most entitled to consideration, which these feelings have the least concern in producing. The guardians of our public seminaries may be supposed from their situation to have no private feelings or partialities to gratify by their appointments. In ordinary cases, they can have little inducement to act for any other than the general good, and that will be a dark day for our land when these institutions, the nurseries of learning and religion, future pillars are to be obtained, shall be denied their claim to the most valuable men whom the church can furnish. Much disquiet is often produced in a parish by the reported intentions and informal propositions of a society abroad to get away their minister, even when this imprudent agitation of the subject does not issue in a formal invitation. The Second Church in Portland had much experience of this species of trial. When Park Street Church in Boston was left vacant by the removal of Dr. Griffin, Mr. Payson's charge had unpleasant apprehensions of losing their beloved pastor. It is in allusion to this time that he says in a letter, "We have been kept in a fever here all this winter by perpetual alarms from Boston, because I do not refuse before I am asked, and exclaimed loudly against going. Some of my people suspect I wish to go. I wish Boston folks would be content with being full of notions themselves and not fill others' people's heads with them. It must greatly endure our memory to his surviving flock to learn from another letter what were his secret feelings in relation to this matter. My people, I never knew before how much they love me. I am amazed to see what an interest God has given me in the affections of my people and even of sinners. It would seem like tearing off limbs to leave them. Indeed, I see not how it is possible, humanly speaking, to get away from them. I have not yet been put to the trial. No application has yet been made from B. Though much has been said about it, it is very doubtful whether any will be made. I feel very easy about it myself, but the church are in great tribulation. Ever since it was first talked of, I have taken special care to avoid everything which might tend, either directly or indirectly, to bring it about. If it comes, it shall be none of my seeking. Several years after this, he did, with the full consent of his people, take up a temporary residency in Boston, and during the few weeks which he spent there, preached to crowded assemblies, and not without apparent effect. Though the work which his friends had laid out for him was too much for his strength, he was wearied with solicitations and entreaties to visit and preach in the neighboring towns. So anxious were those who had once heard him to secure for their friends and neighbors a participation in the same privilege, and so confident were their hopes that he would be the instrument of awakening a general concern for the soul, wherever he should address to men the message with which he was entrusted. In 1825, at the organization of the new church in Hanover Street, he was invited to take the pastoral charge of it. He referred the call to his own church, who decided unanimously that he ought not to accept it, a decision to which he cheerfully acceded. In January 1826, he received a unanimous call from the church in Cedar Street, New York, to become their pastor. This call he promptly, fully, and unequivocally declined. The motives by which he was actuated may be seen from a letter to his mother written a few days afterwards All classes give him full credit for disinterestedness in his conduct on this occasion.
Portland, January 25, 1826. My dear mother, before you receive this, you will probably have heard that I have returned a negative answer to the invitation from the Cedar Street Church. After refusing to accept the call from Boston, I could not do otherwise. If I had gone to either place, I must have gone to Boston, for I think the prospect of usefulness there is greater, all things considered, than at New York. Besides, I never would consent to become a pastor of any church whose members had not heard me preach and become personally acquainted with me. I have not the least doubt that, had I complied with the Cedar Church invitation, the first emotions of the church and society on hearing me would have been those of bitter disappointment and regret. It is true that a removal to New York, where I fit for the place, would, on many accounts, have been very gratifying. I felt no small inclination to go. I should like exceedingly to be near you and my other relations. I should also like a milder climate than this, and I have little doubt that it would be beneficial to my health. But a removal would be death to my reputation in this part of the country. I mean my Christian reputation, and what is far worse, it would bring great reproach upon religion. At present, my worst enemies and the worst enemies of religion seem disposed to allow that I am sincere, upright, and uninfluenced by those motives which govern worldly-minded men. But had I gone to Boston, and much more should I now go to New York, they would at once triumphantly exclaim, "Ah, they are all alike, all governed by worldly motives. They preach against the love of money and the love of applause, but they will gratify either of those passions when a fair opportunity offers." Now, I had much rather die than give them an occasion thus to speak reproachfully. I would be overthrowing all which I have been laboring to build up. Indeed, I can see no reason why God should suffer these repeated invitations to be sent to me, unless it be to give me an opportunity to show the world that all ministers are not actuated by mercenary or ambitious views. I have already some reason to believe that my refusal to accept the two calls has done more to convince the enemies of religion that there is a reality in it than 1,000 sermons would have done. However, this may be, I have done what I thought to be duty. If I ever felt desirous to know the will of God and willing to obey it, it has been in reference to these two cases. Could I have had reason to believe that it was His will, I would very gladly have gone either to Boston or to New York. But at present, I believe that it was His will that I should remain where I am. Not that I am of any use here, but though I could do no good, I would, if possible, avoid doing harm. But little more than a month elapsed before the invitation of the Cedar Street Church was repeated. Some changes in the circumstances led him to deliberate for a time whether the second invitation might be the call of Providence. He considered the obstacles which had opposed his removal as diminished. The church in Hanover Street, supposing that he might possibly be deterred from complying with this invitation by the fact that he had so recently declined a call from them, passed a resolve with a view to remove any difficulties with which that circumstance might have thrown in his way, and wrote a letter urging him to act just as he should if he had never received an invitation from them. This amounted very nearly to the expression of an opinion that it was his duty to go. He was evidently much perplexed. On the one side, he feared doing wrong and offending God by running before he was sent. On the other hand, the circumstances attending his reception of the call induced him to believe that it might possibly be the call of God, and he could not again decline it until he had taken time for prayer and deliberation. "I have ample reason," he writes to the commissioners who tendered the invitation, "to believe that God placed me in this present situation, and I must therefore be convinced that He calls me away before I can consent to leave it. That He does call me away, I am not yet convinced, though I admit it to be possible." After having been long agitated by the perplexing question, it was at length referred to a council mutually chosen by him and his church. To the council it proved almost as tedious and trying as it had to him. They were reluctant to decide against his removal, thinking it possible that a change of climate and situation, together with a diminished necessity of study, might recruit the wasted energies of his body and prolong, for the benefit of the church, his most valuable and useful life.
On the other hand, they found difficulties in the way of recommending his removal, which they were not able to surmount, the principle of which was his want of a full and decided conviction of personal duty in the case. They could, therefore, only advise that, if such should be his conviction, and he should make it known to his church, they would consent to part with him. To the state his mind had nearly approached, when its progress towards conviction was arrested and its purpose changed by increased illness. Sympathies of pulmonary affection, added to his other maladies, excited apprehensions that his labor on earth were nearly terminated, apprehensions which, alas, proved to be but too well-founded. In May, following by the advice of friends and physicians, he tried very thoroughly the experiment of riding on horseback by making a journey through the interior of Maine, New Hampshire, Massachusetts, and Connecticut to New York City, and then to the Springs, where his mind was disturbed by a third application to take the charge of Cedar Street Church, accompanied with most pressing letters and messages from clergymen and others. Though this was declined without much hesitation, yet in the excitable state of his nerves and his universal weakness of body, it was injurious to his welfare, and combined with other causes prevented his deriving any benefit from his journey in an absence of 2 months. The particular trials of mind, writes the Reverend Mr. Welpley, with whom he took lodging, the peculiar trials of mind he had passed through in consequence of the invitations he received to New York and Boston, well might broke him down, as he expressed it, and greatly aggravated his complaints and sufferings, and he had hoped to experience no more trouble from this quarter. But no sooner was it known in New York that he was at the Springs than fresh overtures were sent to him. "I wonder," said he, "that this people will thus pursue a dying man. I cannot help them or myself. I have no doubt from various expressions of his that the great efforts made to effect his translations to a new field of labor proved too much for his weak frame and hastened his dissolution. But those who were so perseveringly solicitous to secure his services knew not how delicate and susceptible were his feelings, nor did they know how nearly exhausted in him were the springs of life. No harsh censure of their measures is intended to be insinuated. Doubtless their wishes had so far affected their judgment as to create the confident expectations that a removal to a new field of action would be the means of restoring and establishing his health. But it was already gone past recovery. That he was held in as high as estimation by the great and good as by Christians in the ordinary walks of life is obvious from the fact that he was, in 1821, requested by persons having some control in the appointment to say whether he would accept a professorship in the theological seminary at Hanover, if elected to the office. But he refused at once and positively on the score of not possessing the requisite qualifications. Had I been suitably qualified, I am not certain that I should not have thought it my duty to go. End of chapter 16, having been read by Peter John Parisius. None of my audios are copyrighted. Please feel free to make as many copies as you desire to the glory of God.